What I'd like to talk about this evening is something I've been thinking about for quite a while, but I hope that it will, that you'll see how it relates, actually, I think, a lot to what we've been doing here this week. And it's a teaching that I really love from the Pali Canon, from the teachings of the Buddha. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to share it a bit with you. And hopefully you will, I hope, enjoy and maybe see how it can support you in your practice and in your understanding of the path, of your path of practice, what practice can be, what it can bring. So some of you probably know this teaching. It's called the Advice to Bahya, B-A-H-I-Y-A, Bahya, who was known as the wearer of the bark cloth. So, and there's a very pithy teaching, that a very short, concise teaching that is in this story. It's in this teaching that at some point I met and sort of just, wow, and sort of carried it around with me for quite a while. And I really commend the practice of committing to memory or learning by heart certain sections of the teaching so we can carry them around with us. It's a really wonderful practice. So I wanted to read you another little bit of the story of this this person called Bahya, and how he 2,500 years ago came to meet this person who came to be called the Buddha, and how he received this particular teaching, and what happened to him as a result of that. And yeah, one of the things that I realized when I was preparing for this was, you probably noticed this week, how personal your relationship with the teachings are. You know, you hear, we've been talking and in the small groups, and there's so much, you know, there's been quite a lot of teachings, but that you connect with, you know, you connect with certain words or phrases or, you know, a theme, and then how that supports you. So as we go through this, perhaps again you can listen out for sort of what sort of most touches you or seems relevant to you. And certainly it was, I think, part of the genius of the Buddha that he could, you know, he could meet people and he knew what to say to them. This is an example of that. And this collection, which is a collection called the Udana in the Itivutika, is a lovely sort of collection of these shorter stories. And it, reading them, I found that it all made it seem so real. Like, oh, there really were these places and these people and the Buddha, and talked to them in different situations, and made it much more real somehow. Some of the longer discourses get very theoretical and kind of philosophical, and these sound like, gosh, this really happened. Yeah?
By my permission, that the Udana has been translated into Finnish.
Oh, great, thank you. Yeah, so this teaching, if you're interested in this one, it's in the Udana, so it has been translated into Finnish. That's wonderful. And there's lots of other lovely ones. I mean, this is just one of the stories in this collection. Anyway, so let's see. Meet Bahya. So, thus have I heard. You'll notice though, a lot of them begin like that. At one time, the Lord was staying near Sarvati in the Jeta wood at Anattapindika's monastery. At that time, Bahya of the bark cloth was living by the seashore at Suparaka. And he was respected, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, and was one who obtained the requisites of robes, arms, food, lodgings, and medicines. So it seems significant, you see, that he, you know, he was already, if you like, on the path. He was practicing and was revered as a mature practitioner, we might say. So I won't read the whole thing, I might sort of paraphrase slightly, but so it says, while he was in seclusion, this reflection arose in the mind of Bahia, and he wondered, am I one of those in the world who are arahats or who have entered the path to arahatship? And for those of you who don't know, the arahat is the word for the person who is fully enlightened, sort of equal in stature, we could say, of the Buddha. So he's kind of asking himself, you know, why is this as far as I can go? Am I on the right path here? Maybe we can sort of connect with some parts of this that we ask ourselves, like, what am I doing? Where am I going? Am I on the right path? And in this story, a devata, kind of heavenly being, appears to him, and you know, maybe that's like when, you know, we get one of those thoughts that comes into our head somehow from maybe some wiser part of us that asks us or tells us things. Anyway, this devata comes and tells him about the Buddha. And so Bahia, it says, profoundly stirred by this news from the devata, that departed from Suparaka and went straight to where the Buddha was. So this is another sort of element of this, I think, is this sense of urgency and sense of wanting to get there quickly. So Bahia arrives. I don't know, sort of imagine him maybe just in this story it says that he walked, stopping only for one night along the way. So it's a long way that he just walked. It's just straight, no stopping. Anyway, so he arrives and He finds the Buddha, and he goes to him and he says, "Teach me Dhamma, Lord, teach me Dhamma, so it will be good for my happiness for a long time." And the Buddha says to Bahia, this is the wrong time. We're just about to go to arms for on arms round, you know. Come back later." Paraphrasing. But Bahia is so insistent, and he says, "No, please, no. It is difficult to know for certain, revered sir, how long the Lord will live or how long I will live. Please teach me the Dhamma." And again, the Buddha says, "No, it's an unsuitable time." And so traditionally, then, you ask a third time. And then he says, "All right, then." Goodness sake, you know. And so This is the teaching that he then gives. And I'll read it, and then really the rest of the talk I'd really like to sort of reflect on that and see if we can understand kind of what's being said here. And I have a number of different translations of it, but this is a good one. Okay, so the Buddha says to Bahia, "Herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus." Heard that word before this week? Train. Train yourself. "In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard, merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself, Bahia." Okay, so far. Okay, maybe fairly clear. Now the second part of it is maybe a bit more difficult. So, when Bahia, we might put our own name in here, when for you, add your name. in the seen is merely what is seen. In the heard is merely what is heard. In the sensed is merely what is sensed. And in the cognized thought is merely what is cognized or thought. Then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then, Bahia, you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So if you've fully understood that, you are now an arahat. Well done. Now, if you're like me, when I first heard that second part, I thought, what? Excuse me. Or maybe you have some idea. The first part, okay, yeah, you know, in the scene, we've been talking a lot about that, haven't we? It's like, what is it to have that more sort of simple, direct, yeah, moment to moment, hearing, seeing, yeah? So that's maybe more recognizable. It's the second part that maybe takes a little more kind of picking apart. What's being suggested here? What's being pointed to? So I'd like to maybe reflect a bit more on the first part of it. Now, when I first got sort of to know this teaching, I used it very much as a lot while I was walking and also sometimes at other times, but as a way to really like bring myself back to reality, you know. So I think it's such a you know, it could be such a helpful tool for your daily life, you know, walking along or, you know, wherever you are, take a pause and thinking, what's it like to drop into that more simple space of, okay, wherever you are right now, okay, in the scene, let there be, you know, training yourself. Okay, can there just be what is seen? Okay, can there just be in the hearing, just the hearing? And what a refuge that can be. And the sense. I mean, I don't know about you, if you notice that a lot of the suffering that can get going is our reaction to our sensations. My reaction to sensations in the body and the sort of tensing up and then the reaction to that, whether it's physical pain or a kind of emotional contraction, and that's like, okay. In the sense, there is just what is sensed, you know. Oh. Dropping out of the reactivity and so on, dropping out of the proliferation. So this kind of process called papancha, which I wanted to kind of pop in here. It's this wonderful word from the Pali, I think, papancha, meaning, you know, the way that we proliferate mentally, you know, thinking about, you know, there's just a sound and then we go off, or there's just a thought and then there's this whole world that's suddenly generated. And how, if we can understand this process, If we can understand that, that's what happens, you know, that's what the mind does. We can begin to unhook from that and kind of shortcut a lot of the process of suffering. So seeing what triggers us off, and seeing that even when the process is kind of going, there's always the possibility of switching to that mode of, okay, can I just be with this? I mean, this is all we've been doing all week in a way, isn't it? I could go on and on about just being with this, you know, seeing what's happening, you know, and like coming into that field, that field of awareness where we can touch and see and not be so hooked into, sort of pulled and pushed along by. And so seeing what we add, and is it useful? And maybe sometimes it is, you know. Sometimes, you know, maybe some of that proliferation can be kind of fun, or, you know, I don't know what the laughing is about earlier, but earlier in our dining room there was some laughing going on because of some daft joke about some Finnish custom being to eat pie from the floor because the pie had fallen on the floor, and then we were all doing what you were doing earlier, and I was thinking, well, there's a little bit of creative proliferation, you know, around some silliness. I'm thinking, so, you know, proliferation isn't all bad and evil, but, you know, to be able to see, like, you know, sometimes, boy, that is what our suffering is, isn't it? That we're just sort of caught in. I mean, that still happens to me, but to be able to, you know, kind of see that and know it and name it as that, and know that in a way it's not really real. Yeah, I sometimes think of training that I once did on a retreat when I was working a lot with envy. You know, it's a big pattern for me, envying others. And so there was this one person on the retreat. I've told this story, some of you may have heard this before, but, you know, who I was really envious of, that person. She became my envy object, you know, because of this and that, and then she's got this and she's also that, and, you know. And so I really, really practiced with it. And I could see, actually, over the period of the retreat, it got better. I was like, yes, you know, this works. Whereas at the beginning, it would just be so painful, and it'd be all this emotion and upset and everything. And I'd see her, and we'd all go, yeah, and it's never, and I don't, and I'll never, and they always, and especially her. It's not fair. And it was really, really painful, and it would just be going. And then, okay, breathe, you know, all these things are, okay, breathe, get big, you know, see, it's just thoughts, feel the feelings, you know, the whole thing, all that stuff, all that good stuff. And it did make a difference. And I feel like it also helped me with that pattern generally, you know, having done that once with it. So not to underestimate, you know, the work that we do here with our impatience or, you know, whatever it might be, that when we face that pattern in our life, we probably find actually we're a bit more, I feel like I can be a bit less hooked in with that. You know, and it can take a while to sort of decondition these patterns. So, yeah, the papancha, the proliferating mind that we can enjoy, but we can also, you know, be really damaged by, to be able to know that. So that first paragraph. So the second part, which is really more difficult, and I mean, being thought about this quite a lot over a long period of time, again, a slow learner maybe, but somehow for me to carry this around, such a source of kind of both inspiration and encouragement and kind of perplexity, and what on earth does that mean? I'm going to read you another version of that and see if you can. Okay, so when for you, Bahia, there is only the seen in the seen, the heard in the heard, the sensed in the sensed, and the cognized, only the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. There is no you there. When, Bahia, there is no you there, then, Bahia, you are neither here nor there, nor in between the two. So what on earth is being talked about here? It connects some with some of what Paul was talking about last night. So what is that? When, what is it that's not happening, not happening when we are fully mindful, you could say, fully present, aware, things coming and going, sounds are just sounds. There's something that's not happening. So let's have another listen to that. So when you are fully, when you are just the sensing, it's just what is sensed, it's just that, it's just sensation, it's just sensing happening, experiencing is happening, experiencing is being known. Can you hear what's happening? It's like what's sensation is being known. So what's being kind of left out of the picture there? So something to do with the unnecessary suffering in our life has to do with something that we are deeply conditioned to insert into experience or lay on top, or it's this sense of me, I, mine. So if I am having this sensation, yeah? I don't know if you can sort of sense into that right now. If you can feel your body, okay, sensing, sensation, body sitting, whatever there's there. Can you locate the I that's experiencing that? Where is it? I mean, maybe you can find something, and you know, when I look for it, sometimes I feel like, well, it's sort of here, it's sort of here, and sometimes it feels like it's sort of here, in my throat, or it's my eyes flickering. It's definitely something happening. No, it's that sense. Yeah, the sense. It's like a, can't exactly locate it, but like. Yeah, it feels like, yeah, there's something. But what you begin to realize, I think, is that it's an idea, it's a thought. It's just another sort of thought or kind of, you know, pattern. So, but a very, 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 very powerful one. And what the Buddha's kind of is kind of like sort of pointing, you know, it's like, straight between the eyes by he goes like, if you get this, if you really, really get this, this great absence, this great sort of illusoriness of this I, that's it, the whole thing. It's like, you know, a pile of bricks, the suffering is like a pile of bricks. If you take the bottom one out, the whole lot just go, pff, there's just no support. It's like, it's like this isn't just an idea. I mean, I hesitated to this is getting quite subtle, maybe. It's not. It's really important not to get hold of this as an idea, which is partly why I'm sort of closing my eyes, encouraging you to sort of explore this as we talk in your experience. Now, there is. You know, this sense of I, okay, maybe somewhere, thought or sensation, and then there's the me or the it, right? The sense, let's call it the sensation, say in your belly, or the sensation of your sitting, you know, on the chair or the floor. Can you feel, can you sort of sense or see or understand there's a kind of an I and an it? Can you feel that it's there? Such a thing? I mean, there kind of is, isn't there? Because we perceive it like that. So, if this sounds like gobbledygook, don't worry. But there's something to explore here. You know, maybe this is sort of the questioning our perception. You know, what's in the bag? You know, what's in the bag? Well, I know what's in the bag. It's me. This skin bag with all the bits and the blood and the bones and this mind thing, you know. It's like, yeah, it's me.
Mostly
whole. Pardon?
Mostly whole.
Thank you, mostly whole, yeah. You mean a lot of space in there?
Yeah.
Holes on the outside and the inside. And yeah, I mean, and this isn't denying anything. It's not saying, like, we're not here. Of course we're here, like Paul was saying last night. It's like nobody's trying to... Ah, but okay, what's the effect? Okay, if you can locate that sense of me in it, can you see that that is actually the basis for friction and struggle? And that I've got to do something with something and got to change it? Or now what happens if there's that shift to, I mean, just say, let's say there's something unpleasant in your experience at the moment, like a body sensation, or I wish Caroline would shut up or talk about some sense, or whatever it might be. Or maybe there isn't. Maybe there's just that sense of locating one's identity around the feeling of being, I am, yep, yeah, I'm here listening, yep, that's me. And that we're doing this all the time in a very, very, very subtle level. And I don't know if you, it's like part of the, what you can begin to experience on retreat is, okay, seeing, hearing, sensing, sense of self, yeah, it tends to quieten at least some of the time. And then we can begin to actually see it and inquire and investigate, now what is that? And how much suffering is somehow, even on a very subtle level, you know, comes out of this me and it, or I and it, I and mine, that duality. So not it's, this isn't kind of asking to believe in anything, but it's sort of opening something up. You know, like the Buddha is saying here, this is a training. He didn't say to Bahi, you know, believe this and you'll be saved. He's saying, train thus. But Bahi was already so ripe. He was already so ripe that, in fact, I'll tell you now, he did achieve full awakening like that. And then he goes down in the records as being the fastest, you know, fastest Dharma cowboy on the block. No, that's not quite right, is it? But you know what I mean. It's the one who got it the quickest in the, yeah. But so you know, for a lot of us, you know, again, I put myself in the slow learner category, but that's okay. It's like every time we can question that sort of process of, you know, when there's something that you just realize you're sort of pushing away, and you're, who's pushing? Wait a minute, you know. Okay, what happens when I drop those sorts of agendas and just, okay, feel the feeling. Feel the feeling. It's another really great instruction of the Buddha, which I love, pithy, concise. Feel the feeling. What happens then when I... One teacher I've also benefited from very much, Charlotte Joko Beck, an American Zen teacher, said something about fear. So can even do it with emotional life. If you are, when you feel fear, just be the fear, and right there, you are fearless. Oh, you try that. And you feel fear, just be the fear, and right then you are fearless. can I read you another translation of this? So hopefully, patiently, and see if you can be picking up a flavour of what this is pointing to. So this translation. Okay. So you can sort of try it as we're talking. I won't read the whole. I'll just read the. So when you're tasting, let there just be tasting. When you're hearing, can there just be hearing? When a thought arises, let it just be a natural phenomenon arising in the mind. When it is like this, there will be no self. There will be no moving about here and there, and no stopping anywhere. This is the end of dukkha, the end of suffering. So is it possible for us to be deeply, deeply involved in our life, you could say, you know, really, really here, really present, really sensitive, really alive, but not so centered on this very pervasive but very, you know, if we can really if we can understand that sense of self arising, we can actually relate to it, not be so defined by it. What might our life be? What might our potential be if we're not so focused on these I-based thoughts? When there is a sense of identification with something that experiences, then, based on the feelings arising from contact, some feeling will seem appealing and worth getting for that self, and some and others will seem unappealing and worth pushing away. So this lack of a kind of central me that has to like and dislike and then either try to get or push away. I don't know about you, but that gets a bit spacious. If you could even get a sense of that. No, it's maybe unnerving or like, what? Or would they say really a basis for living, you know, without that centre from which to, you know, pull and try and get rid of? So I hope that I've conveyed at least something of the profound wisdom in this teaching, and something of how, at least how I've practiced with it, and how engaging with a difficult piece of text, if something in it draws you and catches your interest, and it's really worth persevering with it. You know, one paragraph can change a life. You know, and I say that as somebody who's read a lot of books in my time. I've now become a proponent of one paragraph practice because there's a sense in which when you live with something over days and months and years, that if it's a true teaching, that it will work on you. It will work on you. It will. Yeah.
It's maybe a stupid question.
Yeah.
What happened afterwards?
Okay.
When you reach the course,
yes.
I mean, what happens? Do they still interact with
you? Yeah.
Do
yeah.
They build a house? Do they have sex?
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, the sex question is kind of interesting. I've heard it said that's not possible for arahats, that desire kind of just goes completely. But up to that point, yes. So just stop when you get to arahatship if you don't want to give up the sex. Maybe at that point you have different priorities. I don't know. Maybe.
But my question is that there are a lot of, like for example, I personally like to be like a busy little bee, and I'm always doing stuff, and
that
makes me happy.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to reach any goal where I'd stop doing things.
No, no, it's really, really, thank you, yeah, really important. I mean, the Buddha, you know, talk about a busy bee. He was very busy. I mean, he lived till 80 years old, you know, and had 40 years of teaching and travelling, you know, and like, you know, it's like, he must have met thousands of people, and he had trouble. You know, he also had trouble. His cousin tried to murder him, and I mean, all kinds of things. So, you know. And he, you know, he had to try and set up the monastic tradition. And you can tell from reading, you know, it's like the monks and nuns were always being so pesky. And, you know, he's always having to deal with, you know, naughty monks and nuns. And, okay, we've got to make another rule now because they've been off, you know, gallivanting off here and they're doing this and that. So you can imagine him, you know. And he also had lots and lots of lay students, and some of them were kings, and people like that would come to him and give him hassle. And so I feel like just on that score, you know, it's like he was not removed from the world. But the difference is that there was no craving, there was no suffering, there's no resistance, there's this sort of end of that. Yeah. Does that answer the question at all?
Yeah, in a bit. Way, yeah. But for example, with all this kind of holding, and I have a problem because, like, for example, I personally like Krishnamurti a bit. But anyway.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when he talks about, for example, about the relationships for like man to woman and that love and whatever, but I still don't know, like, did he ever had a woman? You know, like, for example, were they ever normal, like doing all the normal stuff and that? You know, like, or were they born differently already?
No, I mean the story is that the Buddha was a man called Siddhartha Gautama, who was born in a very wealthy family and actually married and had a child. And later on his wife and son both became his students and disciples. Yeah. And the story is that he, at a certain point, he just had this great spiritual crisis, you know, and left because he woke up to this existential question about what on earth, you know, what is my life, and he had to go and find out. So yeah, he did live through that, and I guess a lot of the people who became monks and nuns did also, and also that he did have a lot of lay followers who practiced and achieved very high realizations. I don't know if any of them were arahats, but many of them were, you know, extremely mature practitioners. So it was obviously very possible for people who were, you know, kings and princesses and tradespeople, and, you know, there's lots of stories of lay people. So, you know, it's a very, you know, different in terms of the form, but the core teachings are still the same and can be applied, whatever your situation. On the basis of an ethical life, that would be the key kind of component, sort of whoever you are, that you're living a harmless life. I think without that's a sort of prerequisite to any kind of sort of path attainment for a lay person or a monastic. But yeah, it's maybe different, but maybe not as different as you might imagine. So, thank you. Yeah, great. Any other thoughts or questions? Good. This, well, sorry, you can tell by my tone of voice, not, well, it's sort of sad and sort of, but there's a, anyway, I'll tell you. So now through this brief Dharma teaching of the Lord, the mind of Bahi of the bark cloth was immediately freed from the taints without grasping, which is another way of saying that he, all the last remaining shreds of delusion and grasping were cleaned away, and the last fetter is the fetter of conceit of self. So that last remaining shred of that was cleared away. Not long after then the Lord, having instructed by him, then the Lord went off to get his food, because remember he hadn't got his arms around yet. It's like, oh, has he got that done? Now I can go and have my breakfast. Not long after the Lord's departure, a cow with a young calf attacked Bahi of the bark cloth and killed him. So Bahia's sense of urgency was very, very well placed. See, he that was it for him. But the good thing, you still want to leave you on that note, has a happy ending. He says that, well, so they took by his body and they, you know, they gave him a very noble ceremony and all that. And then it turns out that he had attained final nirvana, which in traditional terms means that he had freed himself entirely from the round of rebirth, that he no longer had to come back into this realm or any realms of suffering, and that he had gone beyond all of that. So I think that's quite a happy ending. So I like to think of Bahia with his bark cloth. I was sitting by the seaside, practicing away, and then travelling to see the Buddha. And having all the last remaining shreds of delusion fall away, and a great revelation. So maybe that's a good place to stop. So let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments.